Mr. Sadat should be in Washington by now. Mr. Begin is on his way from New York to Washington. And the President has returned from affairs of state in Elk City, Nevada, to Washington. And tomorrow, under a big tent on the lawn outside the White House, barring unforeseen last-minute concerns of language, translation, an agreement will be signed between Israel and Egypt, providing for a phasing in of normal relations between these two countries. I'm afraid that given the way the signing has been organized, it will be seen broadly as a Jerry Rafshoon special, a media event organized by the campaign cabinet of this president in order to buoy up the rather low ratings he has been receiving in popularity polls recently, perhaps even as part of his bid to Oslo to be the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize this year. I can just see the president's campaign advisors gleefully discussing the possibilities of receiving that prize. After all, how would a Ted Kennedy or a Governor Brown or a Governor Reagan argue foreign policy with a man who wears the mantle of a Nobel laureate in peace? And all of us, if we've been reading our own papers, have seen in the letters to the editor columns of our daily press a spate of anguished cries from the citizenry, complaining that without having voted a campaign contribution to the president, they are being asked to make such a contribution to his 1980 reelection campaign through the medium of the approximately $5 billion that these arrangements between Israel and Egypt will require of the United States over a 3 or 4 year period. Now, it would be naive of any of us who believe that there is great significance in the agreements that are being signed to argue that the president has not acted out of and is not acting out of concerns for domestic politics. He wants to be reelected, and the opportunity to have this agreement signed in his presence, avuncularly smiling on the two heads of what are tantamount to client states, that this is surely a contribution to his image, his appeal as a leader, as a statesman of consequence in the world. He knows it, his advisors know it, and surely though the United States would have been involved in the Middle East and have sent Secretary Vance or Under Secretary Atherton here and there, everywhere in the past, much as we have done, and though our positions would not necessarily be different than they have been, the willingness of this president to involve himself personally is his prestige. Last September in Camp David, and this last month in the very difficult and lengthy negotiations which have taken place, testifies to the importance, the domestic political importance, which the president and his advisors assign to this agreement. You know, the fates have not smiled upon this president. He wanted the office desperately, and I often wonder if he still has that same taste for the office. He came to the presidency at a time when energy issues were paramount, and he has not been able to resolve them. He came to the office at a time when inflation was beginning to heat up, and he's not been able to diminish the rate of inflation. Came to her office at a time when there was great need for an extension of welfare and other services to the American people. He was pledged to extend these services, and he's not been able to do so. He came to an office at a time when American prestige, American power, seen by the rest of the world, was sheathed, and he's not been able to unsheathe it. He's had to listen to the president of Mexico and the president, the prime minister of Israel, and a number of other leaders of small, less powerful states lecture the American people, lecture him on what American policy should be. He's had to see Russia move rather successfully to extend its influence down towards the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. He's seen rather effective moves by the Russians in Europe to neutralize NATO. He's seen Cuban troops move here and there and seemingly everywhere in sub-Saharan Africa, carrying out the will of Russia and of the Third World. And those political coups which he attempted have had a bad habit of coming undone on him. The great moment was, of course, when the Chinese Vice Premier, Mr. Deng, came to Washington. And there was great talk of bilateral relationships and of a great movement towards world peace. And within the week, the Chinese had moved into Indochina, to Vietnam. Wherever he has turned his attention, he seems not to have been able to pull off a success. And the ratings which he has and the popularity polls which are routinely conducted in our papers testifies to a growing reputation for incapacity, inefficiency, indecision on the part of this president. It's not those capacities which caused the American people to re-elect an incumbent. And so there's been a need for a victory. There's been need for a moment of triumph. And clearly, when this moment of triumph comes, as it will presumably tomorrow, this administration is going to see that this signing is televised to the world. There's ballyhooed here and there and everywhere that the president is able to get from it every drop of prestige, of approval that can possibly be milked from the signing. Now, the president was offered this opportunity, not by his own capacity, but really in a strange, paradoxical way by his own ineptitude. He needed an issue that he could make his own, an achievement which would be significant to him, where his role would be visible. And you remember that sometime last year, the United States, frustrated by our inability to make arrangements between the warring states in the Middle East, spoke publicly of reconvening the Geneva Convention, which is to say bringing the Soviet Union back into the political governance of the Middle East. And this is an idea which frightens Mr. Sadat and it frightened Mr. Begin. And at that very time, or a few weeks before, the Israeli intelligence had uncovered a plot on the life of Mr. Sadat by the Libyan government and had revealed the details of that plot directly to agents of Egyptian intelligence. And there was a new sense of possibility between the two major confrontation states, Egypt and Israel, a new mood. And frightened by the ineptitude of our American president, Mr. Sadat and Mr. Begin began the arrangements which led to the visit of Mr. Sadat to Jerusalem a year ago, November. And then the two countries having broken the ice, Egypt having in a sense tacitly recognized the existence of the State of Israel, and Israel in return, Mr. Begin in return, having recognized Egypt's claim to sovereignty over the whole of Sinai, which is to say, having made the theoretic pledge of withdrawal of Israel troops from all of Sinai, these two bold great statements having been made and these actions taken, Israel and Egypt found that on their own they lacked the capacity to break through decades of frustration, of anger, of war, of distance, and all the pressures which surround the complicated politics of the area, unaided, without some third party, they couldn't break through to the point they wanted to get. And here was the chance for Mr. Carter to come in as the mediator, the catalyst, if you will, and to use the power and the prestige and the finances and the promises of the American government in order to achieve something that Mr. Begin, Mr. Sadat, their countries wanted to achieve but could not succeed in doing on their own. And there is no doubt that once having been given this opportunity, Mr. Carter saw its importance to him, to our country, and that he was prepared at great sacrifice and at great danger to his prestige to involve himself personally and totally in these negotiations. You remember the long 9 days away last September at Camp David where he virtually locked himself out of the White House and out of Washington and did nothing else but move between one camp and the other trying to arrange what became ultimately the two frameworks, agreements, one a framework agreement for peace between Israel and Egypt, the other a framework for a more comprehensive agreement involving the whole area. And then again this spring, when the Camp David agreement had fallen upon some difficulties and needed another push. The President deserves full marks for having brought this final agreement into being. Were it not for his personal intervention, were it not for the pledges which the United States has now set down on paper, both to Israel and to Egypt, were it not for the arms and the aid which have been promised to the two countries, it's doubtful that these agreements could have been arrived at. One has every reason to believe that the spirit of Jerusalem a year ago in November would have evaporated into thin air. The President acted out of political interest, of course. But you know, it was Oscar Wilde, I think, who said that the cynic is the man who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. The cynic is ultimately a very shallow person because he is a rather naive, innocent, surprisingly. He believes that we act for one reason and one reason only, when in point of fact, all of us recognize that all of our actions are undertaken for a complex of reasons, for a congeries of goals. The President acted for political purposes, surely. But he also acted out of high principle. He's a believing Christian. Blessed are the peacemakers. He truly believes that this is a contribution to peace. Certainly a major part of the energies he has involved in this activity, energies which can be seen in the speeches and the comments he has made publicly. Clearly, one major thrust in his concern has been a simple, honest concern to bring peace to where there's anger and distance and the danger of war. The President has acted out of political interest. He's acted out of high principle. But most of all, he's acted as President of the United States. He's acted in order to ensure our national interest. And it's terribly important that he make this clear, because unless he succeeds in doing so, he's going to find that in the mouths of the American electorate, when it comes to a year from now in November, this will be remembered not as a moment of triumph, but as another raid on the American pocketbook. What is the American interest in the Middle East insofar as these negotiations and these agreements move that interest forward? The United States took over from Great Britain the colonial interest that Great Britain had in the Middle East at the end of the Second World War. Increasingly, the world has come aware of the strategic importance of that part of the world, both as a place where oil exists in undreamed of quantities and as the key to the control of the Indian Ocean, and therefore of the Third World in Asia and in Africa. As the world has come to recognize the strategic importance of the Middle East, the United States, as the major power in the world, moved to assert her authority over that part of the world. But there were some contradictory problems. The United States was the leader of the free world. In the Middle East, there was only one democracy. The United States was part of the Western world. In the West, there was the terrible crime, the Holocaust, against the Jew. The United States had to establish a basically close, intimate, concerned relationship with the Jewish state. And having established this special relationship, as it's called in diplomatic language, the United States found that there were strategic advantages to this relationship because Israel, being a beleaguered state, having to fight four wars, became the strongest military power in that part of the world. Her army became the most efficient. Her army became the great arena in which American weapons were tested. Her army became the army which captured sophisticated Russian equipment, turn these over to American intelligence so that we were better prepared in our own defenses. So in terms of a special relationship, in terms of strategic relationships, Israel and the survival of Israel became and remain critical elements in securing our national interest. But there's another side to that scale, the side of oil, ports in the Persian Gulf and then in the Indian Ocean, the landmass which would allow Russia to move, as she's always wanted to move, southward, to expand away from the north, simply from interests in Europe. There's a new economic power of the countries of the Middle East. There are the new markets, therefore available to American business and American trade, if only American businessmen can find advantageous reasons and a proper political and commercial climate to carry on their activities. And so there are these two sides to the scale. And they are the policies required to promote both are not identical. In fact, they are often seen to be antithetical. And so in order to promote our commercial and strategic interests in the Middle East, it has become a cornerstone of American policy that we must defuse the Arab-Israel confrontation. There must be a comprehensive peace. Presumably, once Israel and her Arab neighbors have their relationship normalized, America can normalize its relationship with Iraq and Iran and Syria and Egypt and all of the other countries in the Middle East. And we can go about that particular bit of business. But normalizing the relationships between Israel and the confrontation states has proven remarkably difficult. Israel has wanted peace, normalcy. The other states have not. And so when the breakthrough came, when the major confrontation state with the largest army, which had spent the greatest amount of its treasure for war against Israel, when Egypt was willing to talk of what was tantamount to a separate peace, a first step towards this comprehensive arrangement, the American government seized upon that opportunity and tried, and has tried, and is trying to exploit it. When the treaty is signed tomorrow in Washington, that first step will be in place. It's going to be a very complicated step. But the treaty which is promulgated is not a simple one. We're used to peace treaties which say there will be no more fighting. Within 3 months, the armies will withdraw beyond the original borders, and then there'll be normal relationships, and whatever reparations have to be paid will be paid. This treaty is a very complex one. It talks of the beginning of Israel withdrawal within a few days after the signing of the treaty. Within 9 months, Israel must have withdrawn from half of the Sinai. Within 3 years, she must have withdrawn to the pre-1967 border between Israel and the Sinai. It talks about the right of free passage of Israeli ships to the Suez, the right of free passage of Israeli ships through the Straits of Tehran. It talks about the oil which Israel is to be able to buy from Egypt on the open market. It talks about the exchange of certain kinds of diplomatic relationships at different times in this process. And it links, if not in direct words, at least in spirit, it links this whole complicated process to an eventual establishment of something called autonomy by those who live in Gaza and in the West Bank. Now, this word autonomy is not spelled out. It's not defined. Clearly to Egypt, the implication is that, and I suspect to our own State Department, that autonomy means self-government and ultimately a state, with Israel allowed to maintain a few strategic early warning camps someplace along the border. To Israel, as Begin made very clear 2 days ago in his speech to the Knesset, autonomy means very little. It means that the individuals who live in the Gaza and the West Bank will be able to be governed by their own religious law, will have complete rights as far as domestic community planning and things of that kind are concerned, but internal security and external security remain the concerns of Israel. There's to be no state. The larger issues of land use, of water use, are to remain to be decided by the Knesset, and the Israeli settlements are to remain, and Israeli settlers are to be governed by Israeli law, not by whatever laws established for the rest of the West Bank and Gaza. Now, obviously, these two views are poles apart, and they will have to be adjusted in some way. And the treaty agreement is such that there are to be negotiations towards autonomy beginning within a month after the signing tomorrow in Washington. And these arrangements are to be completed within a year. Now, who are to be the parties to this arrangement? That's been one of the much debated issues. The final wording is rather vague. It says only that the discussions must take place between Israel and Egypt, because obviously no one can guarantee that the Arab citizens of the West Bank and Gaza would be willing to go along or even able to go along if they were willing, given the infiltration of the terrorists and the PLO among them. There are many issues. There are going to be many arguments. There are going to be many frustrations. There are going to be many pretexts, excuses, real and otherwise, for Egypt to argue that Israel has failed to fulfill her part of the bargain, and therefore Egypt does not have to fulfill her part of the bargain, the normalization of relationships, the exchange of ambassadors and the exchange of trade and the like. And this is particularly likely if it is to come, that it will come after the evacuation of the Sinai has been completed and Egypt is back in possession of all the territory which she controlled until 1967. It's a very complicated treaty. It's going to require patience and a remarkable amount of goodwill for that part of the world for the arrangements to be worked out. But the United States, as a matter of our national interest, will not be satisfied simply by the working out of the treaty by Egypt and by Israel. Let's assume that 3 years from now, Egypt, because Egypt is really concerned with her own internal affairs, she wants out from the high cost of defense, she has some very serious military problems on her western border with Libya, her satellite, the Sudan, is being threatened by Cuban and other troops coming up from Eritrea and Ethiopia. She has other concerns. Let's assume that Egypt and Israel both are finding a way to live within the terms of the agreement. Our own country cannot. Our own country is committed to a comprehensive settlement. Those are the key words. And we are committed to a comprehensive settlement because we require it for our national interest in order to have easy, free, and uncomplicated access to the governments and to the markets and to the oil of the Middle East. And so it's not a matter of happenstance that every time something has happened between Israel and Egypt after Camp David, after the agreement that was reached by the president during his air flight to Cairo and to Jerusalem a week ago, we have dispatched one or another of our senior State Department National Defense people to Amman, to Riyadh, elsewhere, to tell them what is happening, to try and buy them in to the agreement. And the most frustrating thing of all to the American policy planners has been that those states which they have looked upon as moderate, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, have aligned themselves in the last year with the rejectionist front. Both these states went to Baghdad immediately after Camp David. Both are going to the Arab summit, which is being convened next week, to take action against Egypt and Israel after the signing of the agreement. Both have been strongly opposed to the American position on this interim agreement, and it's hard to see where our planners will find flexibility, either in feudal governments like those of Saudi Arabia and Jordan, who are afraid of being undermined by the terrorists and saboteurs who represent more radical groups within the Arab world, or within the more radical governments of the Arab world who are committed to values quite other than our own and are not take some delight in undoing the interests of the United States. So it is altogether possible that Monday, March 26, 1979, will be a high water mark in Israel-American relationships, and that as the days have become weeks and the weeks become months, we will see again that kind of pressure we saw 2 years ago and 3 years ago from Washington, demanding that Israel make concessions and Israel make unilateral concessions for the benefit of the United States. We'll hear again that what the PLO really wants is simply a Palestinian state and not the total destruction of Israel, not a so-called secular democratic state in all of Palestine. We'll hear again that there are all kinds of ways to solve the problem of Jerusalem. We will begin to hear all kinds of pressure emanating from Washington upon Israel to do Washington's bidding in the hope that this will bring about the solution to the comprehensive problem which American policy aims at. There's another alternative, of course, that the United States say simply to Jordan and to Saudi Arabia, your survival depends upon us, and to act as if this were in fact our policy, to say no more arms, no more aid, unless you become more forthcoming. But energy has been our Achilles heel. We have no significant energy policy as yet. We are increasingly dependent with every passing day upon Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian oil. There are powerful commercial interests in the United States which are determined that we are not to pressure the Saudis in any way, at whatever price they ask of us, in dollars or in policy. And so it's more than likely that Washington will again begin to walk a relatively thin line, but one which is not quite even-handed, which will tilt away from Jerusalem and toward Riyadh. And the years, if you ask what is ahead for Israel, ahead for Israel is a very, very difficult patch, very, very difficult period, in which she will have to maintain her national interest as best she can, despite her tremendous dependency for arms and aid upon the United States. Mr. Begin has in the last month showed himself to be a doughty warrior indeed. He was able 2 weeks ago to face down the President of the United States when push came to crunch. But America holds the power and most of the cards, and that kind of victory comes seldom in the struggles between smaller states and more powerful states. Both Israel and Egypt face an uncertain future. Egypt is now excommunicate in the Arab world. The Arab world is full of xenophobic mass hysteria. Iran is another triumph to those who see the crescent rising and dominating not only that part of the world, but much of the policy of the world. The oil weapon is the new sword of Islam, and they're wielding that weapon very, very effectively. There is a rise in racist Arabic xenophobia. There's a rise in Islamic religious chauvinism, which we see most of vividly in Khomeini's actions in Iran, which have very, very important ramifications for the survival of Mr. Sadat. Sadat represents, as did the Shah, the West, the technological West, the middle class, the professional class, those who basically accept our way of trying to solve problems, skill, technology, research, economic development. There is in Egypt a dozen Khomeinis. They are part of the Muslim Brotherhood, part of the non-professional class. They represent the old Islam, the Islam of the villages, the Islam which has not admitted women into personhood, the Islam which believes that all of modern life can still be governed by the Quran. A year ago, the government of Mr. Dat tabled in the Egyptian parliament a bill which would have increased the rights of women. And this bill had to be withdrawn because of the obstinacy of this Muslim Brotherhood and of those who ideologically go with them. About a year ago also, the government of Mr. Sadat tabled in the parliament in order to diffuse much of the anger of this Muslim right wing, a bill which would have made it a capital crime for a Muslim to convert to Christianity or to any other religion. And only under great pressure was this bill finally voided, even though it passed the parliament. The Muslim Brotherhood and those who ideologically are sympathetic with it is powerful in Egypt. There's also in Egypt a strong left wing, an old Nasserite wing, which like the Marxist Fedayeen in Iran, is prepared to make a marriage of convenience with the village people and the medievalists and all those who want to turn back the clock in order to overthrow the West, overthrow those who have identified Egypt's future with America and with Europe. Mr. Sadat is committed now, irreversibly, irrevocably, to the United States. He needs money. There were bread riots in Cairo just a year ago. There are 44 million Egyptians, and their standard of living is among the lowest in the world. He needs help. He's talked often of an Egyptian Marshall Plan. If the United States is going to sustain Mr. Sadat in power, it's going to cost us a great deal in welfare for the Egyptian people. We've promised already $1 billion of foreign aid this year, but that number is infinitesimal when measured against the total need of the Egyptian people. It must be doubled immediately if the Saudis were to cut off the $1 billion of foreign aid that they send into Egypt every year, and that would only keep aid at the level which it's been in years past. Mr. Sadat is walking on a very narrow edge, he and those who agree with him. He's taken a great chance, in part because he sees that Egypt must solve Egypt's problems first, in part because the economic interests of his class are identical with the economic interests of America in the Middle East at the moment, and in part, I think, because he, like Begin and like Mr. Carter, generally believe that peace is preferable to war. Mr. Sadat has kept options alive. I'm not sure he can use them any longer. But on the one hand, he's spoken and has really accepted at Camp David the concept of a separate peace, where his whole focus of concern was on getting back for Egypt that which was originally Egyptian and then allowing Egypt to concentrate on her other problems once the problem of Israel is no longer an active one. And the other option which he has kept open is the option of saying, what I am doing is testing the Israeli resolve to make a comprehensive peace. This is a first step. If the Israelis do not create a meaningful autonomy on the West Bank and on Gaza, if they don't act on Jerusalem, if there is not some action about the Golan Heights, what will we have lost? We'll have gained back territory and we can move on from there. He can rejoin the Arab League. He can and would be accepted back into the ranks of the confrontation states. We've seen stranger things than that happen in the Middle East. The Middle East has been the area in which Americans have constantly been most surprised. Old enemies suddenly become allies, allies suddenly begin to fight each other, the United Arab Republic comes together and splits apart. Again and again, the Middle East has surprised us because really we don't understand kind of politics by acclamation, by individual leadership, by that occur by tribal groups, which dominate much of that part of the world. We never have. We've never really understood the power of religion, the power of faith, ideology. What's ahead for Israel and for Egypt? Difficult times, uncertain times. They'll constantly be testing each other, war with each other. Each will have to make compromises. Each will have to admit new dangers. Israel, the danger of increased terrorist attack, the danger of an attack of the new bloc of on the north and the east, with Iraq now having joined Syria in a common army, Iran having proclaimed itself a confrontation state, Sadat from assassination, subversion, and the revolution of the Muslim masses. Given two small countries which have made and are making sacrifices for peace, certainly is incumbent upon our country to show some patience, a degree of statesmanship that we have rarely shown in the past. The role of the United States is critical. If the United States shows itself to be weak vis-a-vis the rest of the Arab world, Mr. Sadat will be undone quickly. Because those who are in power respect power. And they will see that the United States can be bought off with a promise, oil or markets or some vague agreement. And they will take increasingly angry positions, increasingly antithetical positions in order to gain more and more from the United States. If the United States begins to pressure Israel again, and there's every reason to believe that she will, the PLO and its allies will see every reason to maintain their position of absolute adamancy as far as joining any meaningful negotiations. Why negotiate for half a loaf when in time you're going to get the whole thing? How dependable an ally is the United States? The PLO read the message of Formosa and understands it well, that the United States can suddenly pull back when it finds a reason to do so within terms of its national interest. And it knows very well that if the United States begins to pull back from its very special relationship with Israel, ultimately Israel must be weakened and ultimately she can be taken. And so the position of the United States is critical. And the testing of this president as a peacemaker is just beginning. We have an agreement. There is language. There will be signatures. But the agreement is only the beginning of the test. How will the president use the great powers of these United States in order to see that the agreement itself remains in place, becomes effective, that in fact relationships are over a period of years normalized between Egypt and Israel? And how will he use his powers to see that the rather just terms implicit in this agreement are not undermined as we try to encourage, force, bribe, browbeat other countries to join in? I don't envy our president. If he wins the Peace Prize in 1979, they may take it away from him in 1980, or want to. The United States now has committed its prestige to Israel and to Egypt. We once committed our prestige to South Vietnam. It was an unfortunate commitment. We learned we came to rue the day, but in the process, we undid some of the glue which holds the Western world together. The fallout from Vietnam was not simply the capitulation of Saigon. It was the weakening of NATO. It was the weakening of Iran. Ultimately, when a great nation commits itself, it either lives up to these commitments and is strengthened in the eyes of the world, or it fails in these commitments, and the world turns more and more to other solutions to their own security. $4 or $5 billion, which the United States will spend for the removal of Israel forces from the Sinai and their relocation in the Negev, for early warning stations, which will be built along the border between the Sinai and Israel, for the foreign aid which will go to Israel and to Egypt in order to allow their economies to survive will be a small price if, in fact, we are able to achieve a meaningful agreement that's lived up to and the larger peace. There'll be money down the drain if we waste this opportunity. Blessed are the peacemakers if they have seichel. Amen.